case is sent to the jury on speculation alone. 10 minutes later, Sumner reads the verdict. We, the jury, vote to acquit Thomas Maloney on charges of incest and murder due to lack of evidence. I stiffen in my seat, and Ephraim reaches for my hand. He squeezes it just hard enough to make me hiss. Careful, he whispers. What? I haven't said anything. You were about to. Only that a woman gossips, I mutter in his ear, and is fined enough money to buy 3 horses, but a man breaks laws, both divine and human, and walks out of court with his hands in his pockets. Would you have them hang him from a tree without a stitch of evidence? Not a single witness came forward to support the accusation, and nary a single concern that Johanna's men stood in court without her. Ephraim squeezes my hand again, but harder this time. How many worries would you have me carry today, love? Those of a stranger as well? It's a fair question, but I cannot help but feel unsettled that a young woman is out there in the world with no one to protect her from those closest to her. My only comfort is that Sumner looks equally disturbed as he makes notes on his copy of the docket. The third case called before the judges is of great interest to me, and once again I search the courtroom for signs of the Fosters. Still nothing. They are cutting it awfully close. Judge Francis Dana takes his turn to address the room. The court will hear an appeal from Nathaniel Whittaker, convicted by the Court of Common Pleas of Lincoln County, of the attempted rape of one Millie Lambert. No relation to Barnabas, I hope, Ephraim mutters. The courtroom listens as Millie Lambert states that 4 years earlier, Nathaniel Whittaker assaulted her in a field in Canaan. He denies this emphatically. Her family testifies that she told them about the assault on the morning that it happened. His family testifies that it couldn't have happened because he was with them, it being a Sunday afternoon, and they all supped together after services. Questions are asked, accusations made, but in the end, this case also goes to the jury without a preponderance of evidence. The earlier conviction is overturned, and Nathaniel Whittaker walks out triumphant. Where are you going? Ephraim asks. Privy, we've been sitting here for hours. They're about to start. Better now than later and miss my chance to testify. I weave my way through the crowd, most of the people standing to stretch or gossip about what they've heard, and step into the bracing air. Fine little puffs of snow drift down from the steely clouds that hover above Pownalboro, and I glare at the sky. I am tired of winter, of snow, of ice, of cold. I am tired of the world being held in suspension between these mercurial seasons. But I do not control the four winds, cannot command the sun to burn hot again. I can, however, empty my bladder and make myself a bit more comfortable. The line to the privy is long, at least 20 people deep, and I shift from foot to foot. The human need for relief is impolite and inconvenient, but really the tavern should have more than one accommodation for such needs. 5 minutes. 10. 15. I glance over my shoulder as the sound of a gavel banging the table resonates through the chill air. Only 2 more people in front of me. By the time I close the outhouse door and throw up my skirts, my relief is replaced by fear, and I do my business as quickly as possible. By the time I make it back to the courthouse, half the room is standing. People crane their necks, whisper. There is a buzz in the air, like static. It makes me tense. Makes me feel as if an itch is snaking its way across my body. What took you so long? Ephraim asks when I squeeze back to the front of the room. Them, I indicate those around us. The line was long. Well, they called North. I see him. He stands off to the side, head bent, whispering with a man I have never seen before. Ephraim sets his hand to the small of my back. He means to calm me, but the gesture has the opposite effect. They also called the Fosters. They aren't here. That can't be.
5 minutes, Martha. They haven't come forward. I've even looked outside. They aren't here. And Seth hasn't seen them either.
But
Judge Robert Treat Payne does his best to call the room to order. He bangs his gavel again. Slowly, the room settles. People take their seats.
This is the last call for Rebecca Foster, Payne says.
Seth makes his way to the front of the room.
Are you Mr. Foster?
He shakes his head.
No, my name is Seth Parker, the attorney representing the Fosters. Are your clients here today?
He clears his throat uncomfortably.
I do not know, but I am prepared to argue their cause regardless. And they also have a witness present who has traveled from Hollowell to testify on their behalf.
He points to me.
It seems that you take these proceedings a great deal more seriously than your clients, Mr. Parker. Please excuse Rebecca, Your Honor. She is 8 months pregnant as a result of the assault. Alleged assault.
The man standing beside North steps forward and introduces himself. He is tall and smug and wears a fine dark coat.
Henry Noland, Esquire, attorney for the defense.
He approaches the table and hands Payne a small square calling card.
I traveled here from Boston with my client.
Well, at least Lydia didn't lie about where he went, I whisper to Ephraim. Payne nods.
Thank you. As Mr. Parker was saying,
he glares at Henry Noland.
Regardless of how you define the assault, the fact remains that my client is 8 months pregnant as a result. No doubt why she is not present today, Your Honor. Travel of any kind at this time would prove to be a burden. Yet this circumstance should not prevent this court from moving forward with the trial. I am prepared to argue on her behalf. I have brought depositions, and her witness has evidence as well. Bring the depositions forward, Payne says.
Seth hands both recorded testimonies to Judge Payne, then returns to his place at the front of the room. He reads both accounts aloud for the benefit of the courtroom. No one shifts or speaks until he's done.
Mistress Ballard, Payne asks, and I stand. Do you confirm that this was written by your hand, and that all of the details are true?
Yes, Your Honor.
And have you brought this journal mentioned in your deposition?
I have.
Please, bring it forward.
I lay my book on the table in front of the judges and flip to the pages mentioned in my deposition.
I would like the jury to note that everything is in accordance with her written account.
Thank you, Mistress Ballard. You may be seated. Ephraim takes my hand, rubs the base of my thumb with his. The whisk-whisk of his calloused finger on my skin is comforting, grounding.
We will move on to the cause between the Commonwealth and Joseph North, Judge Payne says.
He reads the charges aloud for the benefit of the court.
It is stated that on the night of August 10th, Joseph North broke into the house of Isaac Foster and made an attempt to ravish his wife despite her many attempts to exert herself against him. She on oath affirmed this at two prior hearings in Kennebec County and has deposed the same. How do you plead, Colonel North?
North looks distinguished this afternoon. Hair and beard have both been trimmed. His suit is new, shoes polished. He comes to stand before the table with his attorney.
I plead not guilty, Your Honor. Then what have you to say regarding these accusations?
Henry Noland takes over for his client. It is a wise move given how North tends to argue and interrupt when not in command of a courtroom himself.
Depositions notwithstanding, accusations notwithstanding, there are no witnesses who can attest that these things did in fact happen as claimed. No one saw my client coming or going at the Fosters that evening. No one saw any crimes perpetrated upon her person that evening. Her only witness is a midwife who tended to her 9 days later, who herself is taking Mrs. Foster's word about these events. Was she hurt in some fashion? No doubt. Is there any proof whatsoever that my client is responsible? None. We have only the word of a woman who did not even bother to show up today to testify on her own behalf. How seriously can she truly take this fabrication? Gentlemen, he implores, turning to the jury and addressing them directly. Come, be reasonable. Will you ruin the life of a good man, a respected man, an upstanding member of a fine community, a man who has served this country honorably in not one but two wars, a colonel, a judge, all on account of rumors and speculations? You are smarter than that, and you are far more honorable.
Nolan returns to his place, and Judge Payne motions for Seth to take the floor.
Mr. Parker, do you have any additional words for the court?
Seth looks around the courtroom, searching for the Fosters one last time, and I wince at the desperation in his eyes. Finally, he takes a deep breath and turns to the jury.
How is it honorable to ignore the undisputed facts that a woman was raped and is now pregnant as a result? No one denies that. They only question her word, her account. They shout witness, as though crimes such as this are ever performed in broad daylight, in the middle of a street. Evil is always done in secret. You know that. Rebecca Foster is a witness, and her account should not be discounted simply because a late pregnancy, one that was forced upon her, has made it impossible for her to travel. She has asked this court to render justice. The real question is whether you will deny her that justice. There is no reason whatsoever to doubt her claims. The defense certainly has not provided any. The truth has been clearly presented, and you must act upon it as the good men, the honorable men that you are.
Seth Parker returns to his seat, jaw clenched in fury, and does not make eye contact with anyone.
The court gives this matter over to the jury for deliberation.
Robert Treat Payne thumps the table once with his gavel, then leans back in his chair. We do not leave the courtroom. Most of those gathered here do not feel the same sense of urgency, however, and they wander out to stretch their legs when the jury retreats to deliberate. The judges slip away as well to make the most of this break. The first 30 minutes isn't bad, but when the time crawls toward an hour, I start to get tense. Sensing my mood, Ephraim grabs my hand and stops chattering about the weather and what we'll plant in the spring. Seth Parker remains as well, but across the room, deep in the throes of a good and angry sulk. There are only 10 people left in the courtroom when the 12 men deciding Rebecca's case return. There is a mad scramble outside when word spreads, and it takes another 5 minutes before everyone has taken their seats. The jury foreman hands the slip of paper to Judge Francis Dana. He unfolds it, reads the words carefully, not once, but twice. Then he hands it to Increase Sumner on his left. I scrutinize their faces for any indication of how the jury has ruled. Nothing. There is not a single clue written on their faces. Increase Sumner hands the paper to Nathan Cushing. He reads, and his eyes are inscrutable. He passes the paper to Robert Treat Payne. Once again, the man gives not even the barest glimpse of emotion as he takes in the jury's verdict. There is nary a scowl, a sigh, no lifted eyebrow or deep inhale. Payne leans across the table and hands the slip of paper back to Sumner. He pushes his spectacles onto the bridge of his nose.
"We, the jury," he reads, voice certain and clear, "declare the defendant, one Colonel Joseph North, acquitted on the charge of attempted rape as it concerns one Mistress Rebecca Foster."
20 years ago. Oxford, Massachusetts, July 7, 1769. The plague fell upon our house during the hottest days of summer. Diphtheria, that old wicked scourge. And even though it did not discriminate among the homes of Oxford, we felt as though it treated our family with particular malice. Ephraim and I waited, certain it would consume the two of us as well, but it did not. Maybe that was the miracle, but it was a bitter one. For we watched each of our children tumble into fever, one after the other, after the other. All six of them limp and coughing, their throats swollen and rashed so badly they could hardly swallow the broth we dripped into their mouths. That wasn't the worst of it. The thick gray mucus that coated the backs of their mouths and throats was enough to drive us to our knees. They couldn't swallow, couldn't speak, could barely breathe. "Is there nothing we can do?" Ephraim asked, holding Jonathan against his chest, both of their shirts soaked through with fever. "Cold baths, broth, licorice and chamomile for their throats, but that will only soothe the pain, not treat the sores," I told him. We did the best we could. We hauled buckets of cold water from the well every day. We soaked the children in the wash tub one by one, but no sooner had we dried and clothed them than the fevers returned. And they cried. Not the angry or frustrated cries that we had grown accustomed to in a house full of children, but whimpers, soft and weak and helpless, like mewling kittens. I held them all as often as I could, but I had six children and only one lap, and even that was crowded by the seventh that grew heavy beneath my ribs. But holding them only seemed to make them worse, hot, sweaty, restless. And yet they all reached for me with limp arms anyway, looked to me with glassy eyes, desperate to feel better. Our prayers accomplished nothing. "Why is this happening?" I asked Ephraim that third week in June, as we collapsed into bed, the windows thrown open to let in a meager breeze. We'd spread pallets across our bedroom floor to keep the children close. "What have we done wrong?" He pulled me to his chest and cupped the back of my head with his big, calloused hand. "It rains upon the just and the unjust, love, and we no more deserve this than our friends or neighbors do." We watched our children weaken, watched their throats swell, watched the gray caul spread across their windpipes, watched their lips turn blue and their breath grow shallow. It was Cyrus we worried most about. For 2 days, he hardly moved at all. Our boy, a mere 12 years old, hovered at the point of death for weeks. But it was Tryphene who went first. Tryphene, the girl we had named after the first woman I attended in childbed. 5. She was only 5 years old. One night, our daughter crawled into bed with us, tucked herself between our bodies. And when we woke, she was gone, cold and still, her hair a pale blonde curtain thrown across my arm. We sent for Elspeth, and even though she could neither see nor help, she stood with us while we took turns doing the impossible. Ephraim dug the hole. Then I placed Tryphene inside. Then he filled it in again, and I set the stone on top. We could not leave the others alone inside, lest one of them expire in our absence. We could not expose Elspeth to their illness, but neither could we do what had to be done without comfort or witness. Elspeth was both for us. It was a cruel thing to ask, but she never faltered. And then she did it again 8 days later. At dusk this time. But Dorothy was only 2. She was the child I had named after my mother, and I cradled her in my arms as I wept beside her grave. It lay beside that of her sister, the soil on top still fresh and dark from the week before. The sight of them was fire between my ribs, a void within my soul. 3 days after that, we called for Elspeth a third time. Martha was the one who should have lived. Martha, our second daughter, the one that Ephraim insisted be named after me. She was 8 years old and looked like her father. She seemed the least ill of them all. She never wheezed, never seemed to lose her breath. Her throat was never covered with the rancid gray sores. But her heart, oh God, her heart grew slower and slower as her illness progressed. It slowed and then it stilled. And then the next breath never came. And the weight of her in my arms, wrapped in linen, was the weight of 1,000 heartaches. I don't remember if I screamed or if I cried. In that whole awful ordeal, it is the one detail I cannot summon from the depths of my memory. I've never asked Ephraim. I don't have the heart. I was certain then that the sickness would take them all. It would take them, and then it would take us, and then it would all be over. It's possible that I even wished for that to happen, as it would be the only way we could be together again, as a family, as God intended. But Cyrus got better. The morning after we buried Martha, he sprang out of bed like a wobbly new calf, wanting water and toast. But when he came to me asking to be fed, his voice was gone. I'd only heard that voice crack a single time with looming manhood, but now it was gone, paralyzed by illness. And though we waited, days, months, years, it never returned. Never more than a gentle croak or groan that he soon became too embarrassed to use. His life was spared, but his voice was stolen, and with it any chance of a normal future. Jonathan recovered the day after Cyrus, then Lucy, the one after that. Their fevers broke and their coughs faded and their lungs cleared. Their voices never so much as wavered. And when they asked after their sisters, we had only tears for an answer. Though you never think it possible, you can celebrate and grieve in the same breath. It is a holy abomination. I want to leave this place, Ephraim told me as we stood beneath the oak tree where our daughters were laid to rest. I want to move somewhere else where there is more land, where we can have a real farm, not just a garden. Somewhere we can start over, perhaps build a mill. What? I looked at him as though he'd spoken some other language. I could not comprehend his words. He had carved Martha's name in the third stone that morning. We had only just set it upon her grave 10 minutes earlier. The tears were still fresh on our cheeks, our hearts still an open wound, and he wanted to abandon them? No, I told him. We cannot leave our girls. Martha, he whispered, pulling me tight against him. Our girls have left us. Only once before had I been so angry that I'd slapped him. And as he had on that hillside the day we married, he grabbed both wrists, startled by my fury. I shook out of his grasp. Ephraim pointed to the graves. They are not here, not anymore. I turned and left him there, alone. 6. The Rushing River, April 1790. Is that a dagger which I see before me, the handle toward my hand? William Shakespeare, Macbeth. Ballard's Mill, Saturday, April 10. I stand on the path, 50 feet from the mill, and watch Isaac Foster ride away. 10 days. That's how long it took him to finally return to the Hook and explain their absence at the trial. He came today without Rebecca, spoke only to Ephraim, and even then he didn't stay for a total of 15 minutes. I walk the rest of the way down the path, tin plate with Ephraim's dinner balanced in my hand, as Isaac follows the drive into the trees, then disappears among the shadows. The days are longer now, and the sky brighter as winter loosens its ruthless grip. It hasn't snowed in a week, and the air no longer burns my lungs. The river is still frozen, however, but it has started to crack and pop occasionally, hinting that it won't be long until the thaw. Inside the mill, Ephraim stands at his work table, furiously stripping bark from a slender pole with his draw blade. It's a two-handled thing, straight as an arrow, and 2 feet long with an edge sharp enough to cut bone. He knows what he's doing and is careful, but still, I wince at the sight of that glinting metal sweeping toward his torso. He wears a long leather apron over his shirt and breeches, but one wrong move and he will need stitches. Or worse. "Where have the Fosters been?" I ask, careful not to startle him.
"In Vassalboro." Isaac appealed his lawsuit to Obadiah Wood.
Ephraim looks up, then wipes a trickle of sweat from his brow.
"They negotiated a settlement."
"Of?"
$100. It's only half of what Isaac is owed, half of what he was promised in his contract with Hollowell. But it will be paid at the end of the month, and is enough to get them settled somewhere else.
And did he say anything of North's acquittal?
Only that he truly believed they'd get a guilty verdict. He doesn't understand how a jury of 12 honest men couldn't see the truth of what happened to his wife.
They couldn't see her at all. Rebecca didn't bother showing up to trial.
My voice is louder than I intend, and Percy rouses in the rafters of the loft. That bird has the nerve to squawk at me. Isaac said she refused to go. Said she didn't have the heart to stand before another group of men and give them details of her shame.
It isn't her shame.
I know. And so does Isaac. But what was he supposed to do? Drag her to Pownoboro and force her into the courtroom? Physically threaten her so she'd testify? He isn't a cruel man. Besides, Seth had her written testimony. You were there as a witness. Isaac thought it would be enough, and I can't blame Rebecca for not wanting to go through that again.
I set Ephraim's dinner on the work table and lower myself to the stool. She told me this would happen. That even if the court found North guilty, it would only be for attempting a crime, not committing one. And what's the worst punishment he would have gotten? A fine?
There was only a small section of bark left on the pole, and I watch my husband strip it methodically away. The blade makes a whooshing sound as it reveals the pale wood beneath. I watch him for a moment, thinking.
The jury acquitted every man tried of rape that day, I say after a moment. But they fined a woman into poverty for spreading lies about a judge's daughter.
The pole is bare now, and Ephraim sets down his draw blade, takes off the leather apron. I believe it would have been different with Rebecca. She's pregnant. That's harder for a jury to ignore.
If they'd had the chance to see her, listen to her, I say.
I'm sure that's what North realized in January when she gave her testimony. He expected them to bring charges of rape against him that day. He knew that a jury would believe Rebecca, so he ran off to Boston and hired a fancy lawyer.
And escaped doing his time in the jail yard, I add.
But he didn't miss his chance for a bit of revenge when he had our son brought in on murder charges.
You think North was behind his arrest?
Ephraim nods. I do. During the inquiry, Judge Parker pointed out that Burgess's death was very convenient for North. I think he sat in that courtroom believing he'd be charged with rape and suspecting that murder charges would follow. So he bolted. And then he found a way to have Cyrus charged instead. I aim to prove it, too.
How?
I'm going to have Paul ask around about this lawyer, Henry Noland, while I'm in Boston.
Paul. He always says it so casually, as if the man he's speaking of isn't Paul Revere. Yes, an old friend, but also a national hero. The silver ink dish he gifted me is but a small part of the favor he owes my husband. If anyone can help Ephraim get to the bottom of what North was planning with his lawyer in Boston for those 2 months, it is Paul.
Eat your dinner, I tell him. It's getting cold. Ephraim goes to the plate and nods in approval.
He stabs a potato with his fork and pops it in his mouth. When do you leave? I ask.
First thing in the morning.
And how long will you be gone?
10 days, perhaps a fortnight, depending on how difficult it is to get information about Noland and make my case before the Kennebec proprietors.
In the week since North's trial, Ephraim has been collecting written testimony from friends and neighbors who will swear to the fact that we have lived on this property since assuming the lease. He will take all of that, along with the letters I found in Burgess's saddlebag, to Boston. But it means he is leaving again. And though the matter needs to be settled, and quickly, I don't like the idea of him being gone. Percy watches us from his perch in the loft, his noble head swiveling this way and that. If I didn't know better, I'd think that he talks to Ephraim sometimes, in his own way. Every so often I can hear his squawk and screech from the house if the air is still. Sometimes I think I can hear Ephraim answer. The ice is moving in the river, I say, and not a moment too soon. I am done with this winter. He looks at me cautiously.
Perhaps it is not yet done with us.
And what do you mean by that?
The water wheel. It hasn't budged. You will know winter has gone for good when it turns again and brings its music back.
Percy flaps his wings as if in agreement.
I glare at the bird.
He took another chicken yesterday. Ephraim crooks an eyebrow.
You're the one who gave him a taste for the things. What did you expect?
I expect him to be a gentleman about it and take only what's offered.
Percy is no gentleman, Martha. He's a wild beast. Don't mistake him for anything else.
A beast, perhaps, but a tame one. Ephraim studies his bird with a quiet thoughtfulness.
There is no such thing.
Well, speaking of wild things, I smooth out a wrinkle from my skirt. Jonathan was supposed to put netting over the chicken rung last week so Percy couldn't get in. He hasn't done it yet.
There are lots of things that Jonathan is supposed to do and doesn't, and plenty that he does but shouldn't.
Then you'd best deal with him as well when you get the chance. And eat the hen on your plate before your bird steals it too. I didn't bring it for him. Ephraim tucks into his dinner as I sort through the contents of his haversack and pack basket to make sure he has everything he needs for the trip to Boston. It all looks to be in order. Once done with his dinner, Ephraim still has a hungry look in his eye, and after putting his plate down, he eases me up against the wall.
What will you do without me?
He asks, sliding his hands around my waist. I have no lack of things to keep me busy.
Oh?
There is much to do in my workroom. Syrups, salves. Those hands drop lower, exploring the small of my back, my hips, my arse. Flax to spin, cotton to comb, I tell him. Slowly, too slowly for my liking, in fact, Ephraim begins to ruck up my skirt. He kisses the side of my neck. Cooking, cleaning.
Sounds terribly boring.
His fingers brush against the soft skin of my thighs. If you have thoughts on a better way to keep me occupied, I would love to hear them, I say.
I think words are wasted at a time like this.
Ephraim lifts me up and sets me on the table, drawing my skirt up around my knees.
I'd rather show you.
Darwin's Wharf. Sunday, April 18. Is it twins? May asks, lying on her back in a soft white shift. I run my fingers across the wide expanse of her swollen belly. She is 6 months pregnant, but looks eight. I feel only the one head. I press my fingers into May's side, just above her hip bones. Right here. And here. I slide my palm to the other side and cup another small mound. It's backside. Finally, I tap the base of May's ribs. And little feet right here, which I'm sure you can feel. Constantly, she laughs. But I'm so big, there must be two. No, your belly is big. The rest of you is quite little. May is small and narrow, and she carries every inch of her baby out front. I think this might suggest a boy. There is some truth to the old wives' tales, but I don't mention it aloud. I have long since learned not to raise a woman's hopes. If they want one thing, they'll almost certainly get the other.
It's just the way you carry, I tell her. Your ribs haven't spread, so you're going out straight instead of wide.
Is that bad, my ribs?
No.
I give her a reassuring smile and continue the examination, poking and prodding. Does anything hurt?
Only my back.
And only sometimes, like when I walk, or sit, or stand. Another laugh. This one helpless, as if to say, what can I do?
Roll to your side.
May heaves herself over with a grunt, and I work my fingers across the dip of her back.
Where?
Lower, nearer my...
Ah.
I pat the top of her bottom, the way I might with a baby, and May giggles.
Yes, there.
The baby is putting pressure on your back. You might ask Sam to rub it a bit at night, if he wouldn't mind. I can see only her profile, but a dimple breaks that one cheek.
It's never taken much convincing for him to put his hands on my arse.
I'm delighted that May is comfortable enough with me now to joke. There is nothing more important in a birthing room than trust. I'll make sure to tell him myself as well before I leave.
Where is he?
May pushes up on her elbow and blows a strand of hair out of her eyes.
The barn, working on the yoke, I think. He wants to start training the new oxen at first thaw.
I look out the window to the dirty gray landscape and the pines no longer frosted white. Hollowell shows every indication of going from ice directly to mud. He's optimistic, I say.
He's a farmer. He has to be.
I help May off the bed and back into her dress. Together we go downstairs, and I leave her with a syrup of goldenrod and bearberry to help reduce the swelling in her ankles. Only one teaspoon per day. Any more than that, and you'll be thirsty, I instruct. Take it just before bed so it can work overnight. But don't be surprised if you're up several times to use the chamber pot. May thanks me, then sees me to the door, and I am startled to realize the air is neither frigid nor unwelcoming. I drape my riding cloak over my arm instead of my shoulders. Brutus is tied at the hitching post, fidgety and kicking at a dirty mound of old snow.
Just give me a moment, I tell him. Then we'll go home.
I walk around the side of the house and toward the barn. I can hear Sam inside, banging on something and cursing rather artfully.
You piece of shite! You broken, filthy cockrobin!
Two loud thumps, as though something heavy has been dropped, then kicked.
Dirty bastard!
Uncertain what I might find inside, I tap the barn door with my knuckles before stepping through. I was right about the kicking. The oxen yoke lies on the barn floor, bent at a strange angle, and Sam gives it one more good whack with his boot. He's been at it for quite a while by the looks of him. Hair askew, jacket off, sleeves rolled up and shirt damp from sweat along his back. I've never known a thing to get fixed by being kicked, I say. What's wrong with it? Sam looks up, startled. Then he points at the yoke.
The beam is twisted.
And cursing it helps?
Aye. Helps me feel better about being stupid enough to leave it out all winter to get wet and warped under the snow.
Sam shrugs then and lifts the heavy piece of wood off the ground to hang it on a rack by the stall. His forearms are bare, veined, and covered with the same coarse red hair that sits on his head.
Let me pay you,
he says, shoving his hand into his pocket. When he pulls it out, there is a mishmash of things in his palm. An old button, a rusted nail, a chunk of salt, a strip of tattered lace, an arrowhead, a piece of twine, and a handful of coins. The flotsam and jetsam typical of any man who works with his hands throughout the day. He starts to count out the money. Save your fee until the child is born, I tell him. These visits are included. He looks at his palm and frowns. But he doesn't argue as he returns the collection of odds and ends to his pocket. His hands are filthy from work. And when he notices my careful observation, He drags them down the front of his shirt.
How is May? He asks.
Very pregnant and uncomfortable, I say.
She is well, though. Nothing is wrong?
She thinks that she's carrying twins.
The look on Sam's face is one of abject terror. Is she?
Just the one, as far as I can tell. Though it does seem to be rather large, like its father.
Is that dangerous?
Not any more than two small ones, I smile. But there is something she needs. Sam lets out a long, relieved sigh.
What?
A back rub. As many times a day as you can manage. A lot of the weight is against her lower spine, and she's little to start with. There's nowhere for the baby to go, so the discomfort might begin to move down her legs soon.
I can do that.
Good. And call for me if she's in regular pain. Sam walks me to the hitching post, and as we say goodbye, someone calls my name in a tone of voice that can only be described as abject fury.
Martha Ballard!
I flinch, because I know that voice. So I close my eyes and gather my wits, because he is one of the last people I want to speak with at this particular moment. But he repeats my name, angrier this time. And when I look up at Sam Dalwyn, I see that a storm cloud has gathered in his eyes and his fists are clenched. Perhaps he has grown fond of me after all, or at least protective. William Pierce sits astride his horse, glaring at me. Mr. Pierce, I nod, as polite as I am able. How can I help you today?
You can come with me.
I am not in the habit of taking orders.
Then let today be a first. Because Sally is dying. And it's your fault.
Pierce Farm. Sally isn't dying, I tell William Pierce. She's in labor. Pray tell how that would be my fault. Instead of answering me, he looks to his wife, and what passes between them is a kind of marital shorthand known to every couple who has been wed for any length of time. They can read each other's expressions, the lift of an eyebrow, the flare of a nostril, gritted teeth and lifted chin, and eyes that gloss over with anger and fear. Volumes pass between them before William points his finger at her.
You explain it,
he orders. Then he turns on his heel and leaves the bedroom, slamming the door on his way out. Please excuse my husband, Bonnie Pierce says. She is unperturbed by his outburst. William is the sort of man built for having sons. Instead, he got five daughters. He's never quite got the hang of it. There's no one to blame but him. Sally is your youngest. He's had plenty of time. You can give a man all the time in the world, but he's never ready for his daughter to turn up pregnant. He wasn't with the others, and it's no different with Sally. Well, isn't this a day of revelations? How long have you known? I ask. Almost 3 months. I discovered her secret the day after North's second hearing, in January. I walked in on her while she was standing in the washtub. There was no hiding it then.
And did you tell William?
Not right off. Bonnie levels me with an appraising glance, looks me over head to toe. There is a frankness in it that I appreciate. He would have only been angry with Sally. We kept it from him as long as we could. He's known for a month.
It's hard to hide a pregnancy that long.
My husband is many things, Mistress Ballard, but attentive is not one of them. And it is winter, and we all do what we can to stay warm. She's tall and stays bundled. It would have been harder in summer, no doubt.
You do not seem much distressed by her condition.
Bonnie shrugs. It's more accepting than nonchalant. But still, I am surprised given William's pious outrage in court this year. She didn't get into this situation by herself. Sally's forehead is beaded with sweat, and her eyes are scrunched closed. She does not see the curious glance I throw in her direction.
Are you saying this child was forced upon her?
Bonnie laughs. Not to hear her tell it. From what I can gather, my daughter was an enthusiastic participant.
A stone settles to the pit of my stomach. Mentally, I turn back the clock. The last time I saw Sally was at the hearing at the end of January. Her father had forced her to testify. Again, about all she'd overheard the day I was in Rebecca's sitting room. The blizzard was howling in from the east, and I thought nothing of the fact that she'd worn her riding cloak during the hearing. Half the people in Pollard's had done the same that day. 6 months. She would have been roughly 6 months pregnant, give or take. How did I not know? And at the frolic a week earlier, I only remember thinking that she'd looked rather buxom, that her dress had been cut to accentuate that part of her figure. Had it been loosened elsewhere? There was nary a whisper in that room about her changing figure, because no one had noticed, because no one has seen her since. Because all five of the Pierce girls inherited their looks from their mother. The auburn hair and the hazel eyes and the full lips. The height they got from their father, however. And this, I think, more than anything else, has enabled Sally to keep her secret. A long body coupled with a long torso and a generous bosom can hide a multitude of sins, especially early in a first pregnancy. Sally, I ask. She ceases writhing on the bed and looks at me, then shrinks back, her pretty eyes clouded with pain. She is afraid, both of what is happening to her and of me as well. When I set a hand upon her bare foot, her flinch confirms this suspicion, and this saddens me nearly to the point of tears. I have never had a laboring woman respond to me this way. I have only ever seen relief in their eyes. There is something I must ask you. No, she shakes her head. The father, Bonnie whispers. She thinks you're asking about the father. I've done the same, 100 times at least. And she'd tell me nothing other than that she loves him and went to bed willingly. If you can get it out of her, then you're more of a miracle worker than people say. I am not asking you about the father, I tell Sally. Not yet, I think. Sally visibly relaxes.
What then?
She pants. This conversation would have been far easier 3 hours ago, before a transition, and the otherworldly sense of agony it brings. The brain ceases to function. The body knows nothing but pain and the desperate need for survival. Lucy, my oldest daughter, has 3 times forgotten her own name in transition. Names and numbers cease to exist. Reality shrinks to a pinpoint of primal existence. I need to know if this child is early or late. I need to know when you last bled. The life of your baby may depend on it. It is a miserable thing I am asking of Sally Pierce as she lies on her bed, head thrown back, sweat beating on her lip. I do not think of myself as an unkind person, but this is perhaps the cruelest thing I have ever done, asking a laboring woman to do math.
Summer.
The word is hissed out between clenched teeth, and I wipe a bit of spittle off my chin with a wrist.
Mid-July, I think.
I count backward, and am relieved to determine that we are well within the window for viability. She's at term. Bonnie Pierce clears her throat. I stopped keeping track of their cycles years ago. It wasn't your job to do so. I know nothing about motherhood other than children will do what they will do, and there is not a damn thing you can do about it. So far as I can remember, my mother never cursed in all her 68 years, and I'm by no means a sailor. But I find that every year that passes, I grow more comfortable with the art. And if I never really liked Bonnie Pierce before now, I am sorry because she laughs at that. Every one of my girls has found themselves in this position. When I look at her in surprise, she laughs again.
Didn't know that, did you?
None of them hid it nearly this long, but yes, all of them took a turn around a hayloft once or twice and ended up thick at the waist before their wedding. I just didn't. She pauses to gather her thoughts. With the others, I knew what they were up to. My oldest daughter as well, I say. And if two women can become friends with one admission, we just have. Time will tell with the others. Bonnie Pierce shrugs. I've always wondered if it was a trait I passed on to them. William married me quickly, of course, but I wasn't much of a maid when he did. I am tempted to tell them both about the woman that Ephraim Ballard married, and the scandal that enfolded us when Sally screams. Here it is, then. She's ready. It isn't fast, and it isn't easy, and it isn't enjoyable for a single one of us in that room. It takes Sally Pierce nearly 2 hours to heave her child into the world. The damage is no worse than what I often see in rooms like this. But she will require stitches, that much is sure. Hello, little one, I say. And if my hands are shaking, as I lift the squalling newborn and inspect him, it is only because I know what is coming. He is beautiful, big, healthy. Not a single deficiency that I can detect. I want to pull him to my chest, cradle him, kiss his face, sniff the dark, chaotic hair. This instinct is so strong that I hesitate to hand him to his mother. But there is Sally with her arms held out, waiting to receive him. This girl, who has always managed to avoid directly meeting my gaze, has no such trouble now. Those big, calculating hazel eyes challenge me to ask the question required by law. She has waited for this moment, defying all other attempts to coerce her into speaking the father's name. I will not give in so easily, however. I take a different tack instead. After wrapping the baby in soft, clean linen, I hand him to her and watch as she puts him to her breast. I watch her first awkward attempts. I watch the grimace and hiss of pain when he finally latches on. I watch Sally watch me, and though it is cruel, I let her squirm in silence. Then I pull needle and thread from my medicine bag. You shouldn't feel much, I tell her, but if I don't do this, you will bleed for days. The only sound is that of a newborn grunting and gulping as he tries to eat his first meal. Every few seconds, Sally winces. Hisses. Yet I don't know if this is because of the vice that has attached to her left nipple or because of my needle. There is no bringing new life into this world without pain, however, and sometimes it assaults us at both ends. What did William mean, I ask Bonnie, when he told you to explain her situation? He thinks I know who the father is. Do you? Honestly, I haven't the slightest idea who it could be. I find that there are many mysteries in this world, but I do not consider the father of this child to be one of them. Bonnie Pierce, God bless her, gives me this moment. She does not ask me to clarify, but rather allows me the pure, unadulterated pleasure of stealing every ounce of thunder from her daughter. There is no surprise here, and Sally takes no victory. Once the stitches are done and the thread has been clipped, I sit back on my stool, take in the full measure of this girl who has caused such trouble over these last few months. You have a beautiful boy, I tell her. What will you call him? I know the answer already, because I have seen the truth of it with my own eyes, yet it is a hammer to my heart when she speaks the words aloud. His name is Jonathan, after his father. Sunday, April 18. Clear and pleasant. Birth. I was called from the hook to attend Sally Pierce, who I found to be in labor. She was safe delivered at 1 p.m. of a fine son. Her travail was severe, but she managed well, and I left her cleverly with her own mother. Sally declared that my son Jonathan was the father of her child. I break the quill. That's how hard I press against the paper. It snaps in half in my hand, and I sit back to watch the ink run down the pad of my thumb. I do not typically pour my feelings into this book of mine, but today there is so much more that I want to say. Yet I am out of ink. I've used the last of it just now, and I've no energy left to wander down in the dark to the mill where Ephraim has left the other disc.
so I wash my hands instead and go to bed. But I do not sleep. I lie awake, aware that my son never came home tonight, and I wonder if he is out cavorting around or whether he has gone to meet his newborn son. North Manor, Monday, April 19. I need another quill and more ink. I meant to send one of the girls down to the mill this afternoon, but they are gone now. My entire brood of children off to the hook to shop and socialize for the evening, and there is no one to run the errand for me. So I gather my journal and make my way down the path. Even now I am rehearsing how I will tell Ephraim that he has another grandson. I doubt he will be surprised at the news, or even displeased. I have never known a man who enjoys being around children more than Ephraim Ballard. But the handling of Jonathan will not be pleasant. As far as I'm concerned, my husband cannot get home soon enough. It is odd to be in Ephraim's space without him. He's been gone over a week, but it still smells of him. Yet without his voice and the constant fluttering of Percy's wings, the mill feels abandoned. No matter. There's the ink on his work table, along with a jar of new quills and the rest of his tools. Ephraim's drawblade and revenge sit in a neat row with the chisels and handsaws, cleaned and oiled, precise, just like the man who keeps them. I do my best not to mess with his things while he's gone, but I do pull a bluish-gray quill from the jar and press the sharpened tip against the pad of my thumb. My husband had been collecting feathers for a week before he left, some from the loft where Percy now roosts, but others from the forest. One can't simply dip a feather into ink and write, however. Ephraim prepares each quill by hand. I'd watched him strip the lowest, finest feathers, then place the shafts into the ashes of the wood stove to harden. He'd looked at me, winked, laughed, and said, "I wouldn't mind if you hardened my shaft tonight." I had no intention of waiting until nightfall, but didn't mention it then, or the quills would be ruined. I'd simply returned his leer and watched as he took the feathers and laid them on his work table. He flattened the shafts slightly until they took on an oval shape, then rounded the tips with his fingers. It didn't take long for them to cool, only moments. Then he shaved off the points at an angle with his knife, followed by a slit at the top so that the ink will draw into the shaft. Such simple things, paper, quill, and ink, but I cannot imagine more tangible symbols of my husband's love. I miss him, and there is much I want to tell him, but no ability to do so yet. I spread my journal open on the work table, mix the ink, and dip my quill instead. Monday, April 19. Clear morn. Cloudy afternoon. The wind very chilly. Mr. Ballard is still in Boston. My girls are at the hook. My boys also. I cannot say why it is so important that I make this daily record. Perhaps because I have been doing so for years on end. Or maybe, if I am being honest, it is because these markings of ink and paper will one day be the only proof that I have existed in this world, that I lived and breathed, that I loved a man and the many children he gave me. It is not that I want to be remembered, per se. I have done nothing remarkable, not by the standards of history, at least. But I am here, and these words are the mark I will leave behind. So yes, it matters that I continue this ritual. The ink is still wet on the page, and I leave it open on the table to dry. I'll collect everything later when I get home. For now, my conscience burns, and I must go see Lydia North. The tonic is in my medical bag. It weighs but a few ounces. Yet to me it may as well be an anchor, for it feels as though I am dragging the full weight of my conscience up the front steps to Joseph North's house. Still, I knock. Once. Twice. Three times I pound the knuckles of my right hand against the wooden door. Finally, after several minutes, It is answered by Lydia. I can see I've woken the woman. Her hair is mussed, her eyes watering, and there are pillow creases along her right cheek.
Martha, she says wary, what are you doing here?
I have come to bring your tonic.
But I thought I was wrong, I tell her,
and I am sorry for being cruel.
Will you let me in?
The house is dark, all the shades drawn, when Lydia leads me through the front door and into the parlor. It is not a manor home, far from it, but as one of the largest houses in the Hook, that is what it's called, North Manor. It sits against a large sweep of hill on the west side of Water Street, overlooking the river. 4 full bedrooms upstairs, a kitchen, study, sitting room, and dining room downstairs. There are glass windows and velvet curtains and wood floors. But I can think only of the fact that Joseph North purchased this house with bounties paid on the heads of his enemies. I wonder if Lydia knows, or if she cares.
Do sit down, Lydia tells me. I can build the fire.
No need, I won't stay long. I lower myself onto the sofa beside her. Where is Joseph this evening? Lydia shrugs.
Out for an evening walk.
It's best that way. I haven't seen him since the trial and certainly don't want to run into him now.
How have you been? Worse. I wish it wasn't so, but...
The headaches?
Every day. Sometimes for hours at a time. Joseph is so patient with me, but I know they wear on him as well.
I should have come sooner. I am sorry for that. Lydia looks at her fingers. They are long and thin, like twigs. She flexes them several times before answering.
It hasn't been fair. For a lot of us.
The medical bag sits at my feet, and I lean down to sift through the contents. Each item is as familiar to me as the faces of those I love. And I let my fingers roam, looking for the right one. There. It is small with a slender neck and a wooden cork. The bottle feels cool against my palm when I pluck it out of the bag and set it in Lydia's hand. You mustn't take too much, I tell her. Only 2 teaspoons a day. Once in the morning, once in the evening. Would you like me to get you the first one?
Please.
Stay here, I'll get a spoon. I leave her, head tilted back against the sofa. The kitchen is small and tidy, located at the back of the house, and I find what I'm looking for in a small basket on the counter. A set of pewter spoons, neatly stacked. Everything in its place. The house feels sterile to me, devoid of all the life and noise and chaos that I am accustomed to. Here, I say, once I am back in the sitting room, as I carefully pour a spoonful of the tonic and tip it into Lydia's mouth. You should feel better soon. She swallows the pale amber liquid.
Thank you.
I expect her to shudder. The tonic is bitter, and the reflex normal. But on Lydia's thin frame, it looks like a seizure. I watch her carefully for a moment to make sure she is well. Let's get you to bed. Rest will help. Lydia lifts an arm, flapping absent-mindedly at the ceiling.
Upstairs.
She can get there under her own power, but I follow her up the stairs just in case. The last thing I need is for Lydia to take a dizzy tumble. But once at the top, she guides me down the hallway and into the bedroom she shares with her husband. I help Lydia into bed and draw up the blanket. The woman looks so small and frail, in so much pain. She mutters her thanks and is asleep within moments. I have known only 2 other women who suffer from the dreaded migraine, but neither were this debilitated. When the headaches descend upon Lydia, she is all but crippled, requiring a cold, dark room and no interference. Watching her now, I regret my cruelty. The woman is suffering, and I had no right to deny her any form of relief, regardless of what her husband has done. Let me know when you need more, I tell her. I set the bottle and teaspoon on the small bedside table, then tiptoe from the room. Down the hall, back to the parlor. I collect my medical bag and am almost at the entrance
when I see that North has left the door to his study open. I would have thought him a tidier man, but no, there are papers littered across his desk, books cracked open at the spine on every flat surface. The small paneled room smells of pipe smoke, dust, old books, and candle wax. North has a straight-backed chair and a bookcase behind the desk. There is a wooden trunk beneath the window, and on the far wall, a side table with a decanter and two crystal glasses. The candles are all burned to an inch, and I reach out to touch the one on his desk. There are flakes of rosemary and lavender in the pooled wax. They're mine, I think. I made these. Of all the things to give me pause, just a candle. A simple thing. But a reminder that I am a woman who makes and heals, not a woman who snoops and schemes. But if not me, who? If not now, when? I turn, intending to leave, but my gaze falls on his desk. It is an orderly sort of chaos. Letters, surveys, and maps are strewn across the polished wood surface. Many of them are in Ephraim's hand, and all of them relate to North's work with the Kennebec proprietors. I recognize the map of Hollowell and the survey of our property. There is a letter, only partially drafted, in North's handwriting. I lift it from the desk, read it aloud. As per our discussion last month in Boston, please find the enclosed land surveys of 300 acres between Mill Creek and Burnt Hill. I think you will find the lumber quantity and access to the river meets your growing needs to supply the shipyards in Boston. I am ready to assume the lease immediately, and as agreed, I will take ownership of the aforementioned neglected Ballard lease. 12 years to be prorated to myself, and the deed finalized in April. Having a closer proximity to the property will better allow me to supervise the clearing of this forest. I stand there, paralyzed, gripping the letter. He has intended to take our land all along, and not just ours. He wants half of Hollowell. The realization is sickening, but I am out of time because I hear the sound of boots on the porch, and then the front door swings open.
Lydia?
North's voice echoes through the first floor. He is 12, perhaps 15 feet away, when I make my decision. My last seconds are spent stuffing the letter into my medical bag. I am at the side table, decanter in hand, when he steps through the door to his study.
What are you doing in here?
North demands, his voice laced with fury and contempt. Beside him, Cicero growls low in his throat. When I turn, I lift one of his crystal glasses. A finger of amber liquid sloshes at the bottom. Brandy, for your wife. It will help settle the tonic in her stomach. The dog takes a menacing step toward me, and I see a freshly healed wound on his head, a long, jagged pink scar that runs diagonally across his snout. No doubt a run-in with a sharp set of talons. Well done, Percy, I think. I do not apologize for being in his study, nor ask his permission, as I brush past him and go up the stairs, medical bag tucked in tight beneath my arm. He follows closely behind, furious glare burning into the back of my head as I wake Lydia and help her drink the brandy. Once more, I give instruction for the tonic, and again Lydia thanks me for coming. I neither look at North on my way out of the house, nor do I wish him farewell, for I do not trust myself to speak. Pollard's Tavern. My hands are trembling when I push through the door to Pollard's Tavern. I need a moment to gather myself before riding home, and I also need a whiskey, or perhaps two. Mistress Ballard, is everything in the right? Moses follows as I make my way through the crowd toward the only empty seat in the tavern. I nod, but don't speak. I drop to the stool with a huff.
All the tables are full, and the atmosphere is merry. Loud. There are more people here tonight than usual. I listen to the laughter and chatter as I settle into my solitary place in the corner. One of two rickety stools arranged beside an old wine barrel for a table. It's where Amos and Abigail usually perch. But they are bustling around the tavern, busy with their guests. And I know they won't mind me taking their place. I'll take whiskey if you have it, I tell Moses. And whatever your mother has made for dinner.
'Tis stew and bread, he says, eyeing me with concern. But tonight she has cheese as well, along with roasted chestnuts.
I wag a hand at him in approval. All of it, please. I relax for a moment, face pressed into my hands. And when I finally look up, it is into the quizzical gaze of my daughter, Hannah. Dolly sits beside her at one of the tables, and Cyrus and young Ephraim are here as well. Their backs are to me, and each of them looks like Ephraim from behind. Broad shoulders and dark hair. They tuck into Abigail Pollard's food. The table is full. Barnabas Lambert has come down from Vassalboro and sits by Cyrus. Dolly isn't so much ignoring Barnabas as Cyrus now. She keeps her back to her brother, resisting his attempts to reconcile her with the young officer of the court. My daughters do not forgive so easily as my sons. For his part, Barnabas seems content to bide his time. He may have lost the battle, but he knows he's won the war. The youth of Hollowell are out this evening, enjoying this first glimmer of spring, a night with no bite in the air. Brothers accompanying sisters, sisters dragging their little brothers along, young men with their minds bent toward courtship, and young women making them wait for a stolen kiss. Every so often, I see Cyrus turn his head to the door, waiting, watching, hoping for Sarah White, I'd guess, but she never arrives. The other tables are equally packed, mostly with men I do not recognize, and I am grateful that my sons are here tonight, along with Moses and Barnabas, because more than a few interested glances are being cast toward Hannah and Dolly. Once Moses has delivered my food and drink, I ask him who all these strangers are.
The Boston Militia, he says. They just rode in from Fort Halifax this afternoon. Word is they'll be here for a week before heading south again.
It's been a year and a half since the militia last rode through Hollowell. A year and a half since Sarah White was seduced by their leader. This reminds me of something, however, and I grab Moses' shirt sleeve. Do you happen to know who's in charge? A Major Henry Warren, by chance?
I think the odds of Sarah's bow returning to the hook are slim. Men of his sort usually turn to new hunting grounds.
I can ask around, Moses says.
Thank you. Hannah slips from her seat and comes to give me a hug. We didn't know when you'd be home, so we decided to have dinner here. Honestly, none of us wanted to cook. She shrugs. Dad was gone, you were gone.
And Moses is here? I ask.
Hannah smiles, broad and lovely, her brown eyes crinkling at the corners.
Aye, he is.
You don't have to explain.
I'd rather eat Abigail's cooking than my own any day.
Go on, enjoy your evening. I'm heading home as soon as I eat. You don't want to stay?
I'm tired.
She studies me with those dark and steady eyes. There's more to it.
Aye, there is.
But you won't tell me? I brush a bit of hair away from her eyes. It's nothing you need to trouble yourself with tonight.
Then I'll leave it be, she says.
For tonight. Hannah wanders back to the table, and I watch the delicate mating dance between her and Moses. He brings her a mug of cider, and she touches his wrist. She smiles, he blushes. He makes a joke, and she laughs. It is all so simple and innocent, and I am struck by the realization that the dance of new love is many miles behind me. I could warn Moses and Barnabas that I expect them to get my daughters home safely tonight, that I don't want them near any of these militiamen. But there's no need. I doubt either man intends to let my girls out of his sight.
Dolly might be making a show of her anger toward Barnabas, but I can see her lean in his direction when he tells a joke. I can see her try to hide her smile, and he sees it as well. The boy has a great deal of work ahead to win her back, but she has chosen him, and that is obvious to anyone who cares to look. Moses is back again. I asked some of the lads about Warren, but they say he isn't here. I figured as much.
That's a problem?
No, I tell him. More like a relief. Young Ephraim shoves his plate aside and goes to play dice with the youngest Pollard child.